This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's Genjo Koan. Gaining enlightenment is like the moon reflecting in the water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water disturbed. Although its light is extensive and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch across. The whole moon and the whole sky are reflected in a dewdrop in the grass, in one drop of water. Enlightenment does not disturb the person, just as the moon does not disturb the water. A person does not hinder enlightenment, just as a dewdrop does not hinder the moon in the sky. The depth of the drop is the height of the moon. As for the duration of the reflection, you should examine the water's vastness or smallness, and you should discern the brightness or dimness of the heavenly moon. So this morning I wanted to speak a little bit about humility. which is trying to think of direct references to humility in the teachings. I mean, in a sense, it runs throughout, but there's a kind of a dynamic in practice which is helping us to bring forth true confidence, which is very different from arrogance. And yet, and within that confidence is humility. And I seem to have a dim memory of humility being a virtue in the world at one time. maybe we can read in the history books and see when that was. and so this morning we're completing this retreat that we had over the weekend on the Four Immeasurables, this teaching that originated with the Buddha, that is a meditation and a practice, an offering, but a practice of meditation to realize the basis of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And so we spent the weekend looking at that. And so I thought humility might be a nice way to round that out. Because what is compassion? How do we cultivate compassion? And what do we need to learn or to examine and develop in order to do that? You know, to practice not creating harm and to bring forth what is beneficial. Something so inherent within us, something that we want, and yet something that in our daily stage and the world stage is clearly not so difficult, not so easy to realize. And so Avalokiteshvara, the great Bodhisattva of compassion, realizes mind that all beings have one fundamental nature, one essence. And arising with that realization is the awakened heart, in which nothing is forsaken. And so in awakening, we realize that to forsake a single grain of sand is separating heaven and earth, creates a gap between past and present, turns some people into Buddhas and some people into ordinary beings. It's like forsaking the sky, forsaking the earth, which we do daily. And in that forsaking, we in that very moment become entangled, and life becomes difficult. So Dogen says, gaining enlightenment is like the moon reflecting in the water. The moon doesn't get wet. The water's not disturbed. And so this image that we've all seen before, the moon reflected in the water. And so in practice and realization, nothing changes. Right? In the beginning of practice, that can sound like very bad news. Right? Because we come here sort of with the great hope and an apparent promise from the teachings that everything is going to change. But what do we, when we think of things changing, what does that mean in our mind? What is the thing and the thingness of the thing that is going to change? Everything is impermanent. And so how can I say that nothing changes? When we understand how, from a dualistic or the point of view of samsara, what change means, then that begins to make more sense. Our desires, our attachments, our entanglements are not extinguished. Wisdom and compassion are not acquired or gained. A deluded being doesn't pass away, and an enlightened being doesn't appear in the world. Practice does not disturb the person. The person does not hinder enlightenment. And so the fact that we have all of these perceptions and experiences seem to speak otherwise is exactly the place where practice occurs. We want to change the thing. If I change the thing, my perception, my experience of that thing will change. I want to change you. If you change, then my experience will be what I want. And that's dukkha. Trying to control the world. But it's not so much to control the world, it's to arrive at the desired experience on the level of perception, a sight, a sound, a taste, a thought, an emotion. So what Dogen is saying is that fundamentally, it is not a matter of disrupting samsara into enlightenment. The person does not hinder enlightenment. Enlightenment is not hindered by us. And he says, the depth of the drop is the height of the moon. And so the deeper the water, the greater the height of the moon. The greater the height of the moon, the more radiant its illumination. Right? If it's only a foot above the ground, it illuminates, but it's a very small arc. And so that's why the ocean is so often used as a way to imagine, to sort of conceptually grasp the sense of our limitlessness, our boundlessness, our nature. And then Dogen says, as for the duration of the reflection, gaining enlightenment is like the moon reflecting in the water. And so looking at that reflection, he says, as for its duration, we should examine the water's vastness or smallness and discern the brightness or dimness of the heavenly moon. The reflection seems to come and go. Practice of enlightenment continues endlessly. Everything comes and goes. That's why it's so important not to get overly excited when we have different experiences that arise naturally in the course of practice and meditation. Insights, deepening levels of meditation, the settling of the mind, the body feeling more peaceful, all of these things are good and are indications that our practice is developing and are natural. But when we get too excited about the experience itself is still dukkha. Not because it's a negative thing, but because it's impermanent. It comes and goes. And so what generally happens is as it fades, we can't preserve it. And then we try and go back and recreate it. We can't do that either. And then we get frustrated. And so the experience comes and goes. That's not what we're trying to do, is to hang on to an experience. It's the understanding that experience brings or makes available to us. The direct experience of that is that understanding. And so the deeper the drop, the higher the moon. There is practice and realization. There is harmonizing inner and outer, integrating. what we have experienced, what we understand, and what we're able to embody. And that's always the sort of the fundamental imperative of practice. Live it. And that is endlessly unfolding. We're not in that, we're not developing our Buddha nature. Buddha nature is not developable. It doesn't change. That is Buddha nature, that which is not conditioned. What is being developed is our insight and our embodiment of that, our ability to live what we've realized to be true. And at every step along the way, to the degree that practice is still an idea, a concept, an aspiration, a faith, all of which are essential, it's the ability to integrate that, to live in accord with that. The reflection of the moon rests within the water. And so Dogen says, examine that water, its vastness, its smallness, this moment, this action, this responsibility, this body, this life, this water, this Buddha field. Vimalakirti says, this Buddha field is the field in which we intermingle. You know, life, in a sense, is just about intermingling with each other. Moving amongst, amidst, and intermingling. And in that intermingling, our karma, right? Our sense of who we are is intermingling. And there are many ways in which that's very beneficial and beautiful, and there are other ways in which it's not so great. And so that's part of being in part of a Sangha, is being conscious of that, taking responsibility for that. My impact on you be as beneficial as possible. If that's true, then that means I'm doing some good work. When it's not true, it means something's not quite cricket. Practice is always occurring within time and place. There is no other time or place where it happens. Now. Now. No one has ever let go of something yesterday. No one has ever realized something tomorrow. That's this body of water that we're examining. And the water and the moon are not disturbed. Nothing fundamentally changes. And body and mind, we have the experience of release, of letting go. And that is in our perception, and it is real. And also, it is not as it first appears, but it's real. And so that release is from bondage, from the bondage to our thoughts, our kind of imprisonment of our thoughts, our attempt to domesticate our emotions. And the alternative is not to be wild, right? That's just, in a way, a different kind of domestication. To liberate everything from its false sense of sovereignty, so that that estrangement between that sense of ourself and our true body, between subject and object, between our aspiration and fulfillment, between life as an idea and what is lived, is seen through. Then how is it? And so Dogen says, when the Dharma does not yet fill our body and mind, we think we have enough. When the Dharma fills the body and mind, then we realize something is missing. Mizumi Roshi, about this line, says, ordinarily we think when the truth doesn't fill our body and mind, we think that it's not enough. In fact, some of us may believe that the reason we practice Zazen is to fill our body and mind with the truth until we feel that our understanding is adequate, is complete. What actually happens is that usually after our first realization, our first insight, we feel as if we occupy the whole universe, and we become somewhat arrogant and overestimate our accomplishment. Of course, that may be a necessary stage to pass through, because we're just doing what we do with everything, which is we grasp at it, try and reify it, create a new identity within it, and then run it up the flagpole. He says, but as long as we think we've accomplished enough, it's not true accomplishment. The deeper your realization and the clearer your wisdom, the more clearly you see how much there is for you to do. And in this way, wisdom gives rise to compassion. And that wisdom also is humility. Being humbled within the realization, not conceptually, but the understanding directly of the boundlessness, the endlessness of this path, and how much there is yet for me to do. You know, I was thinking before I came out, if you think you're humble, is that humility? You know? It's like, you know, people who are truly courageous usually don't know it, because they're not standing back. That in moments of true humility, we don't know it. But what brings that forth, what brings that forth is a conceptual idea of humility. Humility is a virtue. I shouldn't be arrogant. And so I will, act humble. And that's not a bad thing, right? That can be a way of reflecting on and taking up. But when we see for ourselves, and he's talking about, you know, this arising out of realization. But long before that, when we just are met with the reality of this conditioned mind, the depth of our waters of habitual thinking and acting, if we are not humbled by that, if that does not bring forth humility in us, I think we're not paying close enough attention. We're so conditioned to see things as in terms of a process to a goal. There's a problem, find its solution. Something's broken, fix it. What is the true path? What is the real meaning? Dogen says, for example, when we view the four directions, the world, from a boat on the ocean, where no land is in sight, it looks like the world is circular and nothing else. And that's a direct experience. You're looking with your eyes. Your eyes don't lie. So that's how we experience the world. No other aspects are apparent, Dogen says. However, in truth, this ocean is neither round nor square, and its qualities are infinite in variety. It's like a palace. It's like a jewel. It seems circular as far as our eyes can reach at this time. And so what he's saying there is that we are always experiencing and practicing within a time. And within our senses, we're limited by the extent of those senses, but more importantly, the consciousness of those senses. And so, as Dogen says, we come back to examine the water. Your body, your mind, what arises and appears before you, your relationships, our work, our aspiration, our stability, our patience, our anger, our annoyance, our frustration, the water. Examining. Before the Dharma fills the body and mind, we believe we don't have enough. Right? This is before You know, it's just we're practicing. We see ourselves as somehow lacking, insufficient. If that weren't so, I wouldn't need to do this. My life would be what I aspire for it to be. It's not, so something's missing, right? It's a logical conclusion to come to. If we're still hungry, it's because we haven't had enough food. Get some more food. And so the teachings of the four measurables, we talked about how in the early original teachings, and I read from the ancient text from Buddhaghosa, he says, first, apply them towards yourself. May I know happiness and the source of my happiness. May I be free of suffering before I extend it to others. Which is wholly consistent, he presents, with the Dharma, with the teachings, with letting go of the self, freeing ourselves from self-clinging. Because first, I have to be an example, be able to provide myself an example first to me. I have to gain confidence in the heartfelt desire of wanting happiness and compassion, freedom from suffering, and be able to take in my own good qualities. If I can't do that, right, then there are things that I can't see about myself that are there. If I can't see my good qualities, and you may think, well, but I can see all of my negative qualities, but can I really? What am I seeing when I see what I think of as those negative qualities? Am I actually seeing them? If I can't see my good qualities, can I actually see as they are my negative qualities? I don't think so. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water disturbed. So as we are practicing this particular practice, for instance, we're not trying to create a state of compassion or to transform a heart which is closed or dull or dead and sort of get compassion. We're just trying to, in a sense, awaken or liberate what's already within us. And so we have to enter into that again and again and again. Study this mind, this sense of identity, who I believe myself to be. And really to recognize all those forms of identity that we don't recognize. You know, that's why I say every time you think of in any way, you know, where you can sort of phrase a thought or an experience in terms of I see myself as, or I don't see myself as that kind of a person, having that, acting in that way. That's an expression of identity. And as we begin examining that water, as I spoke about, I think, last week, we tend to think of that as my water, my personal waters, my karma, my actions, my experiences, right? You've got your water, I got mine. Let's keep that straight. All right? But what happens when I really begin looking is I see that my actions, the consequences of those, my mental formations, my attachments, can't be separated from your water. They can't be separated from my family, my neighborhood, my groups, my history, my culture, my country, my world. This water, which started out seeming, you know, manageable, is becoming larger and larger and complex. And so there is humility, right? The recognition as it's presented in the values of the Beyond Fear of Differences, recognition of the depth of our own conditioning and the vastness of the path. And so I think of humility, an aspect of humility, as being in awe. When we're standing in the presence of something great, vast. And the sense of our own, you know, just me, smallness and significance in the midst of this vast, that there's all, it can be a sense of wonder, a sense of dread, right? Of feeling overwhelmed, but a sense, and a sense of humility. But what is humility? You know, look it up in the dictionary, and it defines it as having a low estimate of oneself, of one's importance, having a low social rank, being modest, bringing oneself low, abasement. This is not the humility of the way. It's not based in rank and role. It isn't something that can be imposed upon you. Humiliation is not humility. It's not inherent. And yet humility is incredibly important in every position, in every relationship. In a sense, the more powerful that position, the more responsibility we have, the more important that humility is. And so as a parent or a teacher or a friend or a family member or a boss or a worker. So the root of humility is humus, the earth, ground, soil from which everything comes. Something very, for most of us, very ordinary. We walk on it. We can never think about it, right? We can see it as something just to manipulate, dig it up, move it around, build something on it. And yet it's the basis of everything. We see the depth of our conditioning is not, when we really understand it more, it's not your fault. And I think that's important because we live in a culture of blame and criticism, judgment, harsh judgment. But it is our responsibility. And those are very different. That the depth of our conditioning is the reality of our humanity. This is a universal thing. That's why Buddhism, at its heart, is not about Buddhism. You know, that's why in the early years, if this was almost every weekend, you know, the question would arise, you know, is Buddhism a religion? You know, that was a very urgent question people wanted to know. And what I felt like I often saw was some people really wanted it to be, and some people really didn't want it to be. And that was going to sort of open or close the door, you know. And so I started saying, look, if you find it helpful for Buddhism to be a religion, by God, it is. And if that really doesn't work for you, it is not a religion. What are you talking about? It doesn't care, because it isn't it. What is skillful? And so to recognize that our conditioning is not a fault, it's a reality. And it's conditioned, it's a work in progress, constantly. It is a process. And to think of that, to think of our experience of ourself as a process, it's very different than when we experience and think of ourselves as a just solidity, a thing that is. Because what do you do with that? Not much. Right? Then, you know, dominate, destroy, reconfigure, that all makes sense because you're taking something that essentially is, it's solid, it's fixed, and you're just trying to dress it in differently. Give it a different appearance in the world. But if it's a process, that means it's constantly moving. And that it is dependent upon the waters in which we are, inner and outer. We are subject to this conditioning. We're influenced by it. We act upon it and out of it, but we are not bound by it. It is not determinative. We can define ourselves. Reality doesn't work by definition. It just unfolds. And so we can think of humility as having a realistic view of things. When we are humbled by our conditioning, that means we're gaining a more realistic view, not just of your particular mess, as we often think of ourselves, but you're seeing into humanity, right? You've got your own particular ingredients in the pantry, your own particular stories to tell, we each do, but what you're seeing, the essence of what you're seeing is universal. It's ancient. That's why these teachings, so many, many hundreds of years ago, that spoke to the students of those times, speak to us. And so we're just gaining a more realistic view. So when we feel frustrated or overwhelmed or defeated, I can't do this, in a way that we're just not having a realistic view, right? What we're seeing is not a problem. The frustration is because we think it should be different. Something else should be happening. And that's based on having some idea of how things are supposed to be. We don't yet, that's just showing us, we don't yet fully understand and appreciate mind, body, consciousness, karma. And that can also arise from a sense of completion. You know, we get frustrated because it's like, oh my God, if it's like this now, then how am I ever going to be done with this? And it's that, the tyranny of that thinking, of that worldview, that we are trying to free ourselves of. And when we understand this more and more, and I think the only way to understand it is you got to go into that cave. You got to turn into over and over again and face what is before you. And then and practice it well. Trust the teachings. And periodically go back to the teachings, just the teachings of Zazen. That's what I did in my early years. You know, there was nobody to talk to. I didn't know anybody that was practicing. I had two books. That was my library. Two books. That's because that's all I could find. I had no teacher. And so all I could do when I was confused or lost or I thought, what am I doing? Or I would just go back and look at the basic instruction that was in one of those books. Am I doing this? I think so. Okay. Shut up and just carry on. Stop complaining, stop whining, just do it. But I wanted to make sure I'm doing, I mean, didn't even think of it this way. I wasn't thinking in terms of the teachings. I hadn't really encountered Buddhism yet that I, in a way that I knew. I wasn't thinking of it that way. But I didn't want to just be making this up on my own. So I wanted to try and make sure, am I actually doing what the teachings are guiding me to do? And then that helped me to relax. It's like, okay, I think I'm doing that, so just do that. Just stay steady with that. And that brings forth humility because we realize, oh, this is a little bit more than we thought. It's going to take a little longer than we had imagined. And so I think of this, I paired this with the precept, manifest truth, do not lie. Do not seek refuge in what is not true, in the false. And so why is this a value for the Beyond Fear work? If we're trying to see into, examine the waters of racism, of patriarchy, of male supremacy, white supremacy, why is humility a virtue? Well, if you are doing that work, you know why. Because it is, because we are constantly being met with the disjunction between who we want to be and what we see within ourselves. And so as a white person, a sincere student of the Dharma, right, as a practitioner, right, entering in, you know, not being fully clear about the nature of this self, I have identity. I see myself as a person such and such, fair, just, not racist, not believing that I'm better than women because I'm a man. That's how I see myself. And those are good qualities. But then when I face aspects of myself that don't align with that, that's difficult, right? But when I face it, right, and I engage it, and I gain some understanding, and I take responsibility for that, and I see things shift, that's not only empowering, but it also is humbling, right? Because it just has to keep happening. It keeps happening. It keeps happening. And like Dharma practice, I realize this is not just something that I am going to study until I've got it, and then I'm going to put it away, that this is a path. It is Dharma. And so to face what is true within a culture of embedded and integrated systems of racism and sexism and misogyny is to examine the waters inside and out. And that's why it's important in the same way to not just think of our delusion, right, our particular attachments and, you know, reactiveness and the ways that we respond in ways that are not helpful or that cause suffering, to not see those as purely personal. Because then it's very hard not to get frustrated and self-critical and, you know, punitive. But when I see that that is part of a much larger system of the world, my life, everything I've experienced, I'm responsible, but you've had a hand in it, right? And the you is anywhere I look. Then it's a little bit easier to practice it more correctly, which is not identifying with it. It is my responsibility, but it is not me. Because there is no me. And so then to look at racism in the same way, if I see, I say something offensive, then it's like, oh, that means I'm racist. So now that's who I am, right? So that's hard to work with. Because if that's who I am, what am I supposed to do? But if it's just the experience of this moment based in conditioning, that I have a responsibility for, but is not just of my own doing, right? That is, that I am a part of a process, a collective process, which is very intentional, very methodical, to inculcate in me certain ways of being, certain ways of seeing, and certain ways of seeing others, then it's not so personal, but it still hurts. And so, humility is more apt to come forth, and then we can return to the ground, to that humus, and find strength there, find stability there, and continue. And so to not lie, to not be afraid of truth or to seek refuge in what is not true, is to trust that. Have faith in that. When the Dharma does not fill our body and mind, we think we have enough. And so when we begin to have experiences or insights, or we can just think, I'm a Buddhist practitioner, so that makes me better than people who aren't. Right? And the 10th grade precept is really, in part, a direct caution around that. That is deluded. But it's interesting how when we have insight into the emptiness of the self, that there is no self to be found, there is no high and low, that we get high on that. Right? When we realize there is nothing to become intoxicated by, we get drunk on that. Which means not drunk on the actual experience, because that comes and goes in a moment. It passes. But now it's in our perception, it's in our memory, both our mental and our embodied memory, and now our mind turns to that memory and starts to do its thing. Weave it into something, a new me. And that's why the training is always about drop it, carry forth. That experience is significant, but it is not what you're making it in this moment. have a realistic understanding, see into the basic nature of everything, of everyone, right? And so in a sense, a part of that humility is really understanding that when we have insight, that's not of your own doing, right? That's not something to be haughty about. And that you know, quite the opposite of creating a sense of superiority, it's helping us realize our fundamental nature is the same. It's helping to understand the truth of karma. And that when we see something or someone or a world evolving, what we're seeing is the unfolding of karma. People acting within their own waters that make sense to them in the ways that our waters make sense to us. And if those waters are murky, cloudy, then that's the basis. That becomes the basis. And so to continually be letting go of knowing and entering into that vast, boundless, unknowable, free from notions of arriving, of completing, of attaining, and just to continue to be diligent, just practice. So that's why Dogen says, don't talk about it, don't comment on it, don't turn it into a story, don't put it on your resume. Don't build an app on it, right? Don't try and make money off of it. All the ways in which this is happening, folks. And it's not the Dharma, it's not enlightenment. It's just the same old thing. New package, better than ever, 30% more, lower price, you know, all the hooks. human suffering is universal, and liberation is universal. And so to see into, to realize, gives us confidence, brings forth a natural confidence, right? It begins to dissolve that false view of insufficiency, of lacking, that leads us to look outside, to try another acquisition, something more, something else, and more to come from within. But the coming from within is not this personal self. It's not aggrandizement. What foundation, what castle, what palace will you build in empty space? So this humility is really to be firmly planted in this humus, in this soil, in which we are in steady and responsible contact with, and then to bring forth. So I wanted to finish with a passage from the 14th century mystic writing of Cloud of Unknowing, a Christian text, which I have taken some liberties with, to bring it into our own sort of way of seeing things. Take courage now, and frail mortal though you are, try to understand yourself. Do you think you are someone superior? How can your poor heart be so leaden and spiritless that it is not continually aroused by faith in your own Buddha nature? Do not be deceived into thinking that you are a holier or better person because of your practice or insight. Do not believe you are inferior or insufficient because of your delusions or blindnesses. I urge you, pursue your course tirelessly. Attend to today and let yesterday be. Never mind what you have gained so far. Instead, face courageously what appears before you. If you do this, you will remain in the true way. For now, if you wish to keep growing, you must nourish in your heart the lively aspiration for awakening. You will find humility when you stand in this true path with the knowledge and appreciation for who you actually are. And actually, anyone who sees and experiences themselves as one really and truly is will have no difficulty being humble. For you will clearly see the degradation, the misery, and weakness of the human conditioned mind. And you will also see the vast and boundless compassion that resides within you for all beings. Before such goodness and love, nature trembles, sages stammer like fools, and both saints and demons are blinded by the radiance of the Sun of Wisdom.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.